It's Wednesday, April 9th, 2008, and you're listening to episode 97 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 1 hour and 1 minute. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name is John.
My name is Luke.
My name is Matt.
My name is Carla.
And my name is Dex.
All right, several things real quick before we get down to business here. First off, episode 100 is coming up. And if you guys will recall, for episode 50, we did sort of a look back at the prior year of Fear the Boot. So this year for episode 100, we've got two things we're going to try and do. First of all, we're going to do a one-shot, first time, possibly last time, video cast. And we'll make it so you can listen to just the sound. So if you we'll have an MP3 out there if that's what you prefer. But there's going to be a video element to it. The second thing we're going to do is we are going to look back on the first 2 years of Fear the Boot. So here's where you guys come in. Over the past 2 years, we've talked about a lot of crap. And several people were asking us if any of our views have changed on particular things. Some people have asked us to follow up in more detail on certain issues. Other folks have even just asked, hey, what happened to some of the previous hosts on the show? So if you guys have any questions for Fear the Boot that you want us to tackle in episode 100, send those in to either me or Luke. And I am actually caught up on my email, so sending an email to me is no longer the same as deleting them. So send those questions either dan@feartheboot.com or luke@feartheboot.com, and we will get those together for episode 100. Luke, you want to talk about DieCon real quick again?
Yeah, DieCon's coming up at the end of May, start of June. I don't want to say Memorial Day weekend, but it might be because I didn't look at the calendar. But May 30th or 31st.
May 30th, 31st, and June 1st.
And June 1st. There we go. Okay. It's DieCon in Collinsville here in the St. Louis area. The War Machine tournament there is going to be a huge War Machine scene. $30 for the weekend, $25 if you pre-reg, and you'll get 7 or 8 different tournaments, including a hardcore for all you big War Machine fans out there. So please come on in. We want to see you down here. We want to blow you up.
And if you just can't get enough Dan, I am on two other podcasts that dropped this past week.
You're riding on us.
I know. I just can't stay faithful to this show. First of all, I am on Gamer Traveler. A while back, I recorded a show with Daniel Perez right after our cruise. That episode has just dropped, so I'm on Gamer Traveler. I'll put a link in the show notes. And secondly, I joined Walt Snyder on Core News this past week. Now, Walt's show is not a gaming show. He takes stories from the news, typically the odd and humorous ones, and reads them out, and then we kick him around for a few minutes. I guess I say we, it's actually he and his other host, but I guessed it on this show. So if you're interested in that, I'll put a link in the show notes. Now, one big thing on that, because he's talking about the news, this does get into some political and current events type stuff, which Fear the Boot does not normally cover.
Don't bring it back to our forums, yo.
So yeah, two things. First off, be aware of that when you go in. If you don't want to hear us talking about politics, don't go over there and we won't bring it back here. And secondly, if you want to discuss these topics, Walt has a great forum over there. Discuss them there because we want to keep the show apolitical. The only reason I'm mentioning this is because I happen to be on it. So, but do check it out if you want to, because it was a great show. We had a lot of fun doing it. And Walt's a really good guy, and he's got a bunch of shows going over there. And once we'll put a link to all this in the show notes.
And speaking of things that were great, how about ICON? Since it's clearly 6 days in the future, yes, and you and I have already come and gone.
It's in the future now, but will be in the past when this show drops. So John,
it was amazing to meet Brock from Pokemon and Tuvok and Fry from Futurama. Yeah, Tuvok's going to be there.
Heck, since we're future Tuvok casting, we can just say anything happens.
Yeah,
so
we can. Rutger Hauer showed up, even though he's not going to show up, and I shook his hand.
We were given the D to a South American country.
Yeah.
Finally,
that was the Robin D. Laws though. Award. We own Peru.
Yes. And all of its alpaca population.
Alpaca.
So courtesy redux. Last week we talked about gaming courtesy in uncomfortable situations. And two things have come to transpire. The first is I mentioned that I wanted to bring Carla on to talk about the amount of chairs that have been destroyed in this house to validate my story. So we have her down here for the first part of the show. So Carla, would you talk for a minute about the great tragedies that my gamer buddies have unleashed upon this house?
Well, we're all right now sitting in a mismatch of different chairs because the ones that originally came with our dining room table, I think are 50% gone. And the ones that came with your old dining room table are pretty much broken. And what's weird is the ones that are broken that I think, Matt, you're sitting in one right now, they're metal chairs,
And it's very sturdy, though. I'm impressed. It's holding up well under my
Are those
weight.
Our parents' old dining yes. room or kitchen tables yes. from when we were kids?
Yes, that's exactly what it is.
Yes, so the old metal chairs, and I think Matt's in the final one.
Isn't that one back there behind John, though, too?
I think that's broken, though.
Those are pretty durable chairs. Oh, I mean, those so chairs good. Like predate me, I believe, so they've got to be over 30 years old.
Well, obviously, the metal gets weaker with time, I guess, but
metal fatigue, that's what it is.
Yeah.
Too many cycles.
So I apologize. I was working last week and I did not actually listen to last week's episode. So what happened to Mom and Dad's chairs?
Oh, these have been broken for a while. This wasn't recent. The most recent chair tragedy we have was from one of the skinniest gamers that we've had. Sat in the chair and leaned back. And I believe that's what caused the wood to splinter and finally break. So, yeah.
Was this during the third edition era with hardness and hit points? Or was there a simple flat D20 roll to break the furniture?
The furniture got saving thrown at
Because
failed.
If it was third edition, someone could have worn it out before earlier in the last 6 seconds. And then he could have sat down and just smashed it.
No, I think he just leaned back in it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
The death of most chairs comes from leaning back.
Yeah, and that chair failed that roll, so...
Now, a second thing has happened, which is we have had a game, and Luke, of course, last episode...
I've never had a was talking chair about how, the gaming session.
Oh, none of this stuff has ever happened, Dan. I have no idea what you're talking about.
Well, the pooping, yeah, not the chairs.
And let's talk about what happened last game session on Sunday.
So I'm sitting next to Chad at our game session. Dan's on the other side of him. And we're sitting there laughing, joking around, and I think I'm writing something down. All of a sudden, here, crack, right next to me. And I look over, and Chad's like, Dave, I think I broke your chair. I look over at Dan, and Dan has a smug look on his face like, see, I told
We've
you
We've seen
happens.
It way too many times at our own house.
Was Chad using bad posture?
I didn't even see what he did to break it. I mean, he might have been leaning back, but it's hard to tell. He might have just willed it to break. I don't know.
One of our other fulfilled prophecies, and this one I feel a little bad for, but nonetheless it came to pass, sitting there in the lower floor of Dave's house, he's got a bathroom down there. It's like a fixed-up basement. And this bathroom has no insulation whatsoever in the wall. So anything you're doing in there, you might as well just be doing out on an open floor. And
that's what my room is.
One of our poor gaming fellows went in there, apparently was a little bit sick and ate some things that didn't quite disagree with them. And it sounded like he was molesting a moose.
All of a sudden, we all start cracking up laughing. Then we hear him and they're going, like he could hear.
No, there's nothing like dumping the full 180 degree green apple splatter. Well, everyone within earshot can hear you. You know, your apartment mate and his girlfriend are out on the futon and you're just dropping the fat man and the little boy. And you're kind of laughing, just wondering how they react.
Yeah, this was a, it was weird. It was like last week's episode just came to pass in the span of our gaming session.
Luke did not believe, so I ruled from on high that it should happen, and it was so.
I don't think Dave and Laura are going to like too much. You willed their chair to break.
No.
Does that make you legally liable?
Yeah, I think it does. Now you're culpable. You said it on the air. We have it on tape.
I will myself not to be legally liable, so let Congress catch up with
that. Well, I guess you're safe now. Well, can't argue much with that.
Drawing people into the start of a campaign.
Haven't we already talked about this so much?
No, we complained about how first games suck. We haven't said anything about how to make them better.
I thought we had, actually, but I mean, there's always more advice there, I think.
Right, I think we've talked about starting a campaign before. We've talked about planning a campaign and executing a campaign, but there's some angles here that I think we can attack that we've not hit before, and that's what I want to go after, and this is fresh on our mind. Because in addition to Luke seeing his first chair destruction this past Sunday, it was also
first gaming chair destruction.
Okay, fair enough. It was also the
tables match.
Start of the first game of a campaign. And Luke, do you want to talk about what happened in that?
Oh, why do you always put it on me? Because I'm going to get IM
because
from
I get bitched at about the Danek shares.
Because you're loud as hell, and you'll actually talk about it and defend your poorly thought out position.
That's what I do best. Or I just stay
well,
at Dan's.
It's either that, or we're
going
to do a whole
happen.
Episode about how to get chicks to play.
Actually, that's not a bad idea, but we've already got enough for this episode, so we'll do that.
No,
next
I've
time.
Heard a whole episodes about that from other podcasts, and it's painful.
Oh, well, we can listen to them and tell them what they got wrong.
Okay,
I'm not naming names.
Anyway,
are they in the laundry business?
Oh,
never mind.
The do my laundry in.
Yes,
that's awesome. So anyway, Dave's campaign kicked off this week, as we've talked about. He's running Savage Earthdawn, and Dave really knows Earthdawn well, and I had fun the first session, but I think Dave was a little disappointed with how he ran it afterwards. because he started us off, we're supposed to be playing in a certain city. The adventures he wants to run, the campaign's going to take place mainly there. But for reasons of foreshadowing, he wanted to start us off in a different city, which we just saved in our backstory. The trouble was, the trouble that happens at the start of campaigns a lot of times, when you want characters to care about something, but they're brand new, they really don't know, you know, they know a little about the game world, they know a little bit about each other, but if we don't have something to do there, then there's really no connection.
You know, what came to mind when we were kicking this around earlier is advice that I got on starting a book. And this is advice that I'd heard before, but I got it most recently from Mr. Tony Mast, so I'll give credit where credit's due. But this is something that everyone out there could think about. We've all read books where it was a really good book, but it took you 30 pages to get into it because they don't start off with anything that grabs your attention.
I'm looking at you, The Stand.
Snow Crash comes to mind. I read the first 30 pages of Snow Crash. I was in. I was hooked. I wanted the whole rest of it to be more pizza delivery action.
And, that was the best pizza delivery ever.
And it just fell apart. I mean, the more I got into the book, the worse it got. And I just wanted to go back and read the pizza delivery again.
Fortunately, most campaigns go the opposite way. It starts a little slow, and then as people get to know each other and the plot and NPCs, it gets much, much better. But that first session, it's, you know, as a GM, that's always the hardest part, is that first sentence of starting the game of like, and we've begun. It's like, all right, I've got to bring it, and you've got to have a plan. And I think Dave had a good plan, but he didn't account for the fact that all the stuff that would have made us care about the town, we had done in our backstory. The battle was over. Cleanup was done. It's time to move on.
It's just like physics, man. You got to beat inertia.
Yep.
Nothing's harder than starting from a step.
So it sounds like he followed a lot of the right steps in that he had all the characters' backstory tied into where he was beginning.
Oh, yeah.
There was a gap.
See, I have all the faith in the world in Dave, and I think he we were talking about this later. He's like, yeah, I really should have had stuff for you guys to do there because there was really no point to be there. And I'm like, yeah, you're right, but you know what? It happens.
I think sometimes there's the feeling that you shouldn't really dive right into the main plot arc at the get-go. You want to have a sort of kind of little beforehand town, like the newbie towns in WoW. You don't go straight to Orgrimmar. You start in Durotar in a little bitty village. I try to do this in my games, but sometimes you really have nothing worthwhile to do before the story begins.
Yeah, something I found that's helped is don't ask the players what they want to do. Tell them what they're doing. Because if you ask the players what they want to do, there's a lot of uncertainty because they've not played this character before, so they're kind of feeling out the character. They have no idea what anyone else's character is really like, because even if they've read the backgrounds or write-ups, they've not seen them in action. There's no group dynamic.
As you would expect, I hate Dan's character. So
right.
I mean, who would...
Yeah, because my character's the doctor, and Luke just can't get
along.
There's
nothing like actual medical school, right?
Yeah.
Well, there's nothing to bond people quite like shared adversity, too. So if you immediately give them a shared challenge or a shared problem, that's going to probably bond the group.
Well, you know, and that's very true.
That is true.
But that's not exactly the point I was getting at, though that is 100% accurate and very good advice. But I was just more saying that if you wait for them to come up with an action, at this point in the game, they're very uncertain. They have no ambition because there's...
They don't know the world. You can give them the playground, but they can't see 5 feet in front of them. So it's not their fault that they don't know that the
slides
sort of Orkmar is across the waterfall.
Or the slides are fun in the playground example. They don't know the slides are fun. They there's a slide there. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. And even if it's in their background, which is important context, it's never happened to the players. It's only happened to the characters. So the players don't feel it yet.
Yeah, exactly. There's a big gap there that needs to be bridged. And it, as you go on, the backstory becomes a little more vivid, I think, because as you get to know the characters, you can start picturing what really happened when you have a shared backstory type thing. This is one reason to avoid the common problem we were talking about earlier, which was bound to come up, which was the starting in a tavern and getting the quest, is most of the stuff I run these days, when I run my first game, I usually start in media res, or at least close to it, where they're either halfway through a mission or the mission's gone south or whatever they're doing.
Huh? I didn't know what that meant.
Oh, too bad.
Okay.
Too bad.
Maybe you did go to medical school.
Actually, I kind of like that because that's a little bit less ham-fisted than having them all sit in the tavern and then get jumped.
Well, you shouldn't... Sitting in a tavern...
All of a sudden, ninjas come through the ceiling and go after them. I mean, it gives the characters the shared adversity, but it's clumsy. So I like the idea because I've seen it done in other genres, too, where you actually start the characters off midway through their first mission together and something has just gone horribly wrong.
And combat can work, but I would shy away from combat for two big reasons. First off, as you said, Tex, it's just very ham-fisted, very artificial.
Even with ninjas.
Yeah, even with ninjas. The second reason is, I don't know about most people, but in all the games I've played in, where I see the biggest amount of metagaming and kind of pseudo in-character action occur is in combat. Because in combat, whether you admit it or not, everybody wants to win.
Well, you're going for the higher angle of attack.
Right.
You're thinking of a reason why your character gets this perfect shot off, but you're always going for the perfect
shot. You're looking at the numbers. You're playing your character probably with the least amount of personality you will ever play this character during the campaign. And I'm sorry, but having a cliche battle line you yell before you charge is not role-playing.
No, that's not always true. People who actually sabotage themselves in character really stand out, because this is the opportunity.
But it's rare. Yeah. It's rare, which is why I would recommend not starting with that, but start with something that's character-based. Kick off that campaign with a very boisterous NPC, one that has a lot of character, one that's very in your face. So if the PCs are kind of quiet because they're still unsure of the game, this is an NPC that's going to draw them out. It's not going to be somebody that says,
hi. I've seen that NPC cow people, though. It's different, where it's like, okay, that guy's yelling at us. You know, I don't, a good NPC is a good way to start things, but again, you're not really starting. It's something that's going to, I don't see that drawing people together that much. I mean,
being yelled at isn't necessarily engaging, but you can still have a very boisterous or exuberant NPC that engages the players without just shouting them down or acting like a drill sergeant.
Well, you can do that. I'm not saying,
right. The extreme I'm getting at that I'm not in favor of is, for example, an NPC walks and says, hi, how are you?
Right.
And the NPC's like, fine. Good, I'm fine too. And then the NPC sits there silently. Yeah, every once in a while, it's like, oh my gosh, how are you? I haven't seen you in so long. Pause, wait for the character to say something. But have already written out a great big dialogue for this person. So if the PCs get quiet, this is a person who will jump in and pull on them to keep that conversation going. I mean, not shout them down. Not
right, okay.
So, I mean, there's a balance there.
Yeah, my advice would be more to just, the key is give the players an immediate goal. You know, if you have to kind of railroad the very start of a campaign, that's fine. As long as you have choice later, like start them out in your typical D&D, meet in the tavern, you're drinking, some old man comes up and gives you a map. Skip all that. Start. That happened. Okay. Hey, an old man mentioned a tavern. You got a map. You're at the dungeon. Go. That works a lot better than having an hour of, oh, I'm drinking this. I ordered this. Oh, I make a comment. The sexy barmaid. Whoop, whoop, whoop. That we've all done 100 million
times.
Her boobs
jiggle. Sentiently,
like in,
as
DOA.
In Dragonlance,
or in Dragonlance, even better.
Well, I think it's not necessarily the NPC, it's not necessarily the dungeon. It's just putting them in a situation where they have to react.
Right.
They know what they're doing and why they're doing it.
That's a good way. Start them in the middle of the Shadowrun. They're not in combat, but something's gone wrong, and they're trying to avoid combat.
Then you have to play Shadowrun.
Well, think even about like sandbox video games. Think like Oblivion.
Mm-hmm.
Think like Fallout or Fallout 2. In all these games, which are fairly open-ended games, you at least have many ways to get to a goal. Mm-hmm. They all start you off in a relatively narrow situation, right, with an immediate goal. They don't, because I can think of how much harder those games would be if you have no context on the realm. Nothing has occurred up to this point, and you're just standing there with your sword and shield in the middle of a field.
Well, and if you remember back to the advice I gave about the player-driven sandbox games, is that you have to start off with handing people stuff and giving them hooks to, like, start off with your standard adventure, you know, something rather short, add in a bunch of hooks and stuff the players can bite on later. So when they're done with that, they are ready for the sandbox, just like I said, Oblivion does, right, really well. That's the best way and probably the only real way to do it without confusing everybody starting off on a very different page.
Well, right, much like in the video games where you're given a trainer mission, that's basically what the first meeting of a new group should be. It's like your training of how you're interacting with each other, what your different skills are. I mean, that's half of the first session anyway, just figuring out who you're playing with.
That's true. See, one of my favorite, to pat myself on the back, call me Dan Repertor. talking about one of my favorite campaign beginners, actually Renegade Horizon, which you were there for, Matt, where, mm-hmm, where we just started mid-airship. They were rescuing you, and they had just busted you out when things started to go south. And we did start in combat, but it was very, very short. It was very intense, and they were able to get on their way.
Knights of the Old Republic did almost the exact same thing.
It did.
And it was great.
Mm-hmm. Also, the beginning of Necessary Evil started off in a highly tenseful situation as well.
Yeah, it really did. I didn't think about that.
Where literally you're dropped out of the bottom of an airplane.
With a choice to make.
But pull the cord or don't?
Your powers are nullified by this guy who's like, join me or I'm not turning your powers back on and you're going to die. And
oh,
I think didn't one of our campaign guys actually choose not to?
Yeah, and I think he just fell.
No, it was the Magnificent Martin, the guy who haunted you throughout your campaign.
Is this a video game? Or are you guys gaming story dorking onto one another?
Oh hell, we are gaming story dorking.
Because that was pretty bad. Oh hell, I mean that was like a good 2 minutes.
Why didn't you stop me earlier?
I don't know. I just wanted to let you dig your own grave.
Wow. I'm done talking.
You got
forever.
A medical degree. You can figure your way out of this.
That's optometry degree.
Well, one thing I wanted to add to that is, although I'm violating the physics analogy, there is such a thing in gaming, I think, as negative momentum, which is where if you start people off in a game and their early exposure is very boring or very tedious or very unengaging, like you just start them off in a tavern and the group spends 45 minutes sitting around the table role-playing how they order beer and flirt with the barmaid. Now the players have become frustrated or bored or disengaged, and you've got players wandering around and going to the bathroom and going to the kitchen and ordering pizza. And so when you actually want to get something more interesting going, not only are you actually not starting from zero, but you're starting from negative territory because you have to get everybody back from their kitchen break and their bathroom break and their girlfriend's cell phone break or wherever they're off to. And they're also now bored and frustrated.
Girlfriend's cell phone break equals excommunication.
Hey, I'd answer the phone for my wife occasionally during a game.
I'd invite your wife to the game. That's how you get around that, man.
She doesn't want to play. She's played before once. She
don't want to come to the game.
Yeah, not her bag. But I was going to say, there is one worse situation, too, where if you're kind of letting the players roleplay and do their own thing, when the one guy in the group who doesn't really quite get it, or I won't call it the bad player, but who's just not quite on the same page as everybody else, takes over and says, oh, let's go do this. And everybody's like, yeah, that's something to do. It's like, oh, God, no, this is not.
I've had that many times. I think I've told the story once before on the podcast.
A gaming story? Nobody tells gaming stories on Fear the Boot, Dan.
No.
Well, I think I'm the only one this episode unscathed by the taint of gaming story. No, you two text. All right.
I haven't told any gaming stories.
All right.
But we had a vampire game where there was a guy, and I know I've mentioned the story before. He was playing a DA, and he was trying to prosecute a wraith. And you're absolutely right, Luke, that you are oftentimes in more danger when you have no action. There are times when boredom is the least of your worries.
Yeah, when idle hands take over the game, it's never a good thing.
You were eventually going to have somebody pop up and tell them to go north, and in the meantime, they decide on their own to go south.
Well, you have to be careful, too, starting off in a situation that's only really engaging some of your players, because if you immediately engage a subset of your players, then the subset of the players that you didn't engage are going to get bored and wander off, if not physically, mentally.
Well, it depends how engaged you mean. I mean, it's tough to engage everybody's character at once. A lot of people tend to be along for the ride while a few characters take a spotlight. And as long as you rotate the spotlight around, everybody's happy.
Well, especially at the start of the game, just move fast.
Right. You can just throw out a bunch of stuff and see what bites.
Right. And especially if you kick off with something that's either really unusual or really intriguing or really gets everyone else wanting to jump in there, you've done a good thing, because by the time you're done with the first two guys at the table, who maybe were talking to one NPC, and you get to the other two at the table, they're already chomping at the bit, ready to go, because they've got all these things they want to say or do or ask, because mm-hmm. the game has started. You've got that momentum going.
Well, if you have a hook that involves the whole party, but really, emphasizes a couple characters, I mean, you're bringing everybody along, but you're basically forming a couple cheerleaders in the group to really pull the group along.
Well, let me ask you this. As a game master, do you sometimes identify players that you know are going to bite or engage quickly and easily and give them the spotlight first to build that momentum?
Yeah, we've talked about that. You turn to your good players the first few sessions to drive things along, to show everybody how it's done if you've got new players. Or even players who are new to the group, to kind of show what you're looking for in players.
And there isn't so much of a divide between good and bad, although that can exist as new and old.
Another thing to watch out for is if you have a really weird campaign setting or starting in a very strange place, that's not a good place to start. You want to try to start off with normal, because you want to have a contrast. You want to be able to show the difference from normal. You want to get people relating to the game immediately, and if you're going to weird them out, do it a little bit later. You know, you don't want to start out.
It sounds
out
like Luke is saying you should have a call to adventure.
No, I'm not.
No,
not at all.
I don't have the Dragonlance gaming screen
I don't know how to run adventure. I don't have that screen around.
I know, we gave it back to Dave.
I know who you... Well, no, he didn't use it. I thought he was going to use it last time. We just sat next to him the entire game.
I had to yell at him. He wasn't holding it where it shows the hands.
I'm sorry. I just couldn't resist zinging Luke there since he was doing the whole hero's journey thing.
It's really not the hero's journey.
But it's the first part.
No, no, it's not a hero's journey at all.
There's no reluctance in the heroes. They're there to roll
dice.
They're
there to adventure. They don't need a call. They just need a point where to go.
There is no red pill. There is no going back to bed and letting the dwarves walk off. There is experience, and it's out there, and it's not.
Because that happens, it's game over.
To let the dwarves walk away.
Yeah, but then you're late, and that's rude, so you have to go.
Speaking of dwarves and hobbits, John, you've given us a perfect transition here to talk about our next subject.
I have races in games.
That's racist.
Specifically, it is racist.
That's racist.
This is a very racist episode.
It's an extremely racist topic. I'm talking about when you have a dwarf, and it looks like a dwarf, and it smells like a dwarf, and it drinks beer, and it lives underground, and it wears Viking helmets.
This is a grumblekin.
And has a Scottish accent. You can't call it a dwarf. You call it a grumblekin, or whatever the hell you just said.
It's a grumblekin.
Yeah. Or you have these elves, but... they're not elves. They're
the Aizen Labatagi.
Yeah, you're good, Luke.
You got a lot of vowels.
Rip these off. You must have learned this at medical school.
Optometry school.
It's real easy. You've got the race that spells everything with way too many vowels. You got the race that spells everything with almost no vowels, and then you got the race that has at least three apostrophes in every word.
Yeah, the apostrophes are the annoying ones.
That's extremely accurate.
It's important to have lots of clicks in your desert people.
You know, in addition to fantasy, and I've seen this far more, because fantasy's big issue with races is everything's Tolkien.
Yeah, everything is Tolkien.
But I like everything's Tolkien. Sci-fi, more Tolkien.
Sci-fi has its own problem. At least in sci-fi, people will tend to introduce races that, at least in name and such, are relatively unique, but they all...
Everyone in the race is the same person.
There is one personality...
the science race and the war race.
Yeah, exactly. There's one personality that fits everyone in the race. Now, I don't have a problem with that for some races, because maybe that's the racial shtick.
The but Zerg is nice, because they're a hive mind.
The problem you're getting into there is you're confusing the race with the culture. So if we're talking about dwarves, we can say dwarves are short and strong, but if you say that they drank beer and curse and wear Viking helmets, that's culture, not race, racial.
I don't know. Look at the Klingons and tell me they're not the war race.
If all elves live in the trees and play harps, that's cultural. Racial, I think, would be more their physical attributes or limits. And I think it's okay to have a common culture, but I think the problem that you run into is a lot of times people confuse the two, and if they say they're playing a race, like I'm going to be a dwarf, all they really do is play the culture.
Well, I think in many cases, there is no difference between the race and the culture.
Yes, yeah, that's the problem.
People don't know how to separate them.
I think that's a deficiently developed gaming system or a deficiently developed gaming universe, then.
Well, not always, because while everybody likes depth and a little variety, having such a strong stereotype makes something that's different than human very easy to play, but if you do it a lot, it gets really, really old.
Right. Compare, for example, the Klingons to the Zentradi to the clans in Battletech. There's not a whole lot of difference.
Are you kidding? The Zentradi are huge.
Yeah, well, okay, outside of 50
and they
feet.
Have multiple.
There's not a whole lot.
Multiple what?
Wait a minute.
I want to see where this is going.
I'm thinking
but
of the
again,
Centauri.
I mean, that's they my have... point is that's culture. They're talking about this way of the warrior culture or the warrior clan culture. That's not a race. That's a culture.
Well, right. But when the culture becomes pervasive to the entire race.
When the culture
that's
equals
the problem
the
we're
race,
talking about.
That's the problem we're talking about. You bring up a good point. There should be a divide. There isn't always.
Exactly. Because you suddenly hit this point where you get the chicken and egg. Are the Klingon warlike because that's the way their culture is? Or is their culture that way because that's how the race is? So the culture is the natural outcropping of the race's biology or psychology or whatever you care to call it.
And this is endemic in just about, you know, any TV, any media that has something different than human because they want something easily and quickly identifiable.
Exactly.
That's a Klingon. He likes war. He's got a bumpy forehead. Go.
Well, you're right. But in a television episode or a movie, you've got, you know, 30, 60, 90 minutes, 2 hours or whatever to tell a story. And so as a result, a lot of times you use amalgamations or cookie cutter things that you know the audience can quickly identify with. But in a role playing game where you've got, you know, hour long or, you know, multi hour sessions stringing out over potentially months, I don't think you necessarily have to go to those amalgamations or those cookie cutter archetypes to rapidly speed storytelling.
But it's not, the difference is that you're not watching the story, you're part of it and you're playing that role. And if you don't have, if you're playing something that's not human, it's something that's outside of your normal realm of thinking. And for most races in games, they don't want something that's going to be hard to jump into. So you take a few stereotypes and you make them big and you jump into those. Dwarves are Scottish and they drink a lot and
they wear
grumbling.
Viking helmets.
Yeah, they wear Viking helmets, and elves are, you know, aloof and
magical
and better than you at everything.
Journeying out in either the west or east, and
halflings that can't decide whether they want to be small and thievy or small and annoying.
Well, actually, Tex, I think you make a good point, but kind of in reverse, because while in a movie you do have an hour and a half to develop something, in gaming you've got a few sentences to set the mood a lot of time, because you get out that one paragraph, you know, sometimes the players, they begin wandering and losing their attention. So you've got to make impressions fast.
Well, yeah, which is, impressions are big.
But here's the thing, though. I completely agree with what you're saying.
Are Labians a pleasure-seeking race?
But remember that, first of all, you have a long time to develop this race. It's not like you have to explain the race completely in their first appearance. Mm-hmm. Secondly, it's not like the players are incapable of doing any back reading. If they want to play a particular race...
Sometimes they are.
Well, though. But that's by
sometimes
choice.
Sometimes back reading is boring and stupid.
But
and
the, point being, that if the players want to play race X, whatever that may be, then it's not as if they can't pick up the book and read a few columns on it, not a few sentences, but several paragraphs on this, and get a sense that of the diversity of the race. But then on top of that, one thing that's important to differentiate is when you have something show up in a game, there's a difference between introducing a character and introducing the race. That when one guy from this or that race shows up, you can't expect him to be any more representative of the entirety of the race than when one human shows up to be representative of all of humanity. Yeah, I take a look, backing up to what Tex was saying about the difference between culture and race, and I look at humanity. What is the human culture? If I mean anything that's consistent in all human cultures that is not driven by our physiology. And I'm struggling to come up with anything like that. And I realize we get in some debatable areas here, and I'm not trying to...
We all laugh and cry.
Everybody
but
poops.
That's physiology. Yeah, that's true.
It's physiology. Yeah.
So it's... I can't come up with much of anything. These cultural constructs we have are all different from person to person. Some of us are warlike. Some of us are peaceful. Some of us want this kind of government. Some of us want that kind of government. Some of us, you know, we could go on and on like that.
Some of us are real doctors. Other people are jealous.
Oh, my God. Right. You want government, Dan? You've made political statements.
Oh.
Get off my microphone.
Well, if you notice, though, like in a lot of, especially fantasy writing, they will have multiple human cultures. But if they also introduce a race of dwarves, a race of elves, a race of halflings, they'll have a single cohesive culture. And it's only the humans that have... different city-states with different cultures.
Right. Most of the
thinking,
time, man.
The main difference...
of Dragonlance with the gully dwarves who are a little special.
The main difference is, yeah, where they live, and of course, for no particular reason, even though they have similar cultures, they all hate each other.
There's some different racial cultures in Tolkien, but he's
perfect. Well, it seems like rather than having different cultures, they just have different sub-races.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that can happen, too.
Their skin color is a little different, and they get a different bonus to this, but otherwise you play them exactly the same.
To create some useful advice amidst all this bitching, I would say that you can use humans as a good place to start, because the one thing that you can see when you look at yourself is the fact that there is a difference between culture and race, that within the race, we all have certain things that are consistent, but outside of that consistency, we have free choices that can lead us in different directions. That we don't have to all turn out the same. And I try to do the same thing when I'm designing races for role-playing games. I say, okay, here's the thing that are just the way this race is, and you can't get around that. But...
Like the Labians.
What's the freedom of choice?
You can't get around that.
No.
What's the freedom of choice that exists within that? Okay, this race may be intellectual, and therefore they think a whole lot, all right? But just because you think a whole lot doesn't mean you're all scientific. You could still come to different conclusions about the use and application of that intellect. And so we can go from there. I look at the Klingons. Okay, you have a race that's very bestial and angry, but why do they all have to direct that in the same way? And why do they all have to follow the exact
because
same...
Because Kallus told them to?
Well, I think you can also introduce something that's more mechanical from the racial aspect. So, for example, if you want to introduce a race that has a high metabolism and you wouldn't even make that a playable race... then you can give that as something that the player has to deal with, that perhaps with a series of, you know, perks and quirks, if you will, where the perk is because you have a high metabolism, you're very high energy and you can maybe do some extra things. And it doesn't have to be just all combat driven. But then the downside is you have to eat a lot. And so, I mean, but that could also be annoying. I mean, for example, if that character was wanting to stop for 12 meals a day, that could also be irritating. But that's a racial thing that I would think you could then drive a culture with. So you could have a culture that involves a lot of eating because of their high metabolism, but that comes from their racial background.
Called hobbits.
Or yes, cannibals.
And then
or
from there, you can take sort of fish out of water cultural thing when you only have one member of that race traveling with a bunch of more or less humans who has to stop and eat all the time, and then they're pissed at him.
Yeah.
If you do it cleverly and understate it, it's funny.
I've also
you do it every 2 minutes at the gaming table, you get thrown out.
I've also done it where everybody starts as part of a monolithic culture, and as they explore more of the world, they, if you'll pardon the phrase, unlock other races.
I'll pardon that.
New race playable.
I unlocked the Frogglocks in 2004.
You know what I hate?
So what? Frogglock.
I hate cat people.
I hate cat people, too, with the fires of hell.
Animal people
Why
in general.
Why did furries invite themselves into nerd culture?
Animal.
Yeah. It's a sexual fetish. It has nothing to do with gaming or minis.
That's
or
John at fearthebird.com.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry. Let's talk about
did
how much
guys
we hate cat people.
On the internet, this is a couple years ago, they had the whole nerd hierarchy. And
yeah,
I think
we're actually talking about that
we're
at
pretty
Icon.
Close to the bottom
rather,
of the hierarchy.
No, the bottom is fanfic writers who write about Star Trek, except they make it furry, like Kirk as an ocelot or something, and they write themselves into the story.
It is a cool hierarchy. But cat people are the worst of the worst.
Well, I don't like that in general, the whole animal people, that we're going to have frog people.
Except the Kilrathi.
Cat people.
And frog from
I don't know.
Right. Have you ever seen Hell
frog
Comes
was
to Frog?
Awesome,
but he was though. A human. He was just under a specific curse.
Have you ever seen Hell Comes to Frogtown? One of Roddy Ryder Piper's best films. I highly recommend it.
I've read The Adventure in the Deadlands Hell on Earth, one of their books. They have Doom Comes to Frogtown.
Nice.
Yeah, which is a bunch of mutants. I don't know what the actual movie's about, but I assume there's mutants or frogs.
As I recall, he's the last virile man on Earth, and he has a nuclear bomb struck to his junk.
Roddy Piper's the hero
sold.
Always makes me happy. You know, he's great in them.
I've seen it on USA Up All Night twice.
Oh, USA Up All Night was one of the best shows ever. I watched so many good movies hosted by Rhonda Shear back in the day. Oh, it was so good.
Sorority Babes and the Slime Ball Bowl-O-Rama.
I remember
good stuff.
There was some beach movie with a biker that killed people, and it had one of the anchors from Channel 1, which we had to watch in homeroom in high school. I'm like,
oh,
no
that's
way.
Stupid. Okay,
that's a dude from the really bad B movie, and now he's hosting Channel 1. Take that, Serena Al Shul and Anderson Cooper.
So, yeah. Races.
So, cat people suck.
Yep.
And flying elves suck.
Dog people suck, too. Flying anything sucks, unless you're seriously a bird, and it screws with you all
what
the time.
What if you're at war
Fairies.
With the cat people?
Then
you're probably the dog people.
Or you were.
What if a cat person is your co-pilot?
Then you're playing Wing Commander, and that's awesome. I don't know. Do the Kilrathi ever join you?
You can get the one traitorous Kilrathi.
Hobbs?
Yes.
Yeah. His name is Hobbs.
His name's Hobbs.
Yes.
That's
name
awesome.
Is Hobbs.
Yes. That is horrible.
He's got Leviathan on the
side. This one, I think, was actually pre-Calvin and Hobbs.
Someone can actually look this up for me, but is there any relationship between the Hobbs character and Wing Commander?
Dude, Calvin
and
Hobbs came out in 1985.
Dude, do you not understand
95.
The joke we're making here at all about how they are inspired by each other? You missed the boat on that one, Tex.
Sorry.
There's no way that
we're going to blame that
the video game preceded the comic unless it came out for the Atari.
I believe Wing Commander came out in 1989.
It goes way back, yeah.
No, I think Calvin
it was
Hobbs,
back like 286.
You know, Calvin Hobbs came in 85. I know. Yeah. I own the complete collection. Oh. It's my favorite comic ever.
Huh. Yeah, I think,
like the
I think Calvin
chest.
Hobbs definitely came,
yes,
came first. I don't think that's the point worth arguing.
I have read it all.
Kilrathi rule. Fight. They're the only cat people.
I ignored
cool.
my family on Christmas morning to read the essay forward that Bill Watterson put in it like 2 years ago.
It took you all morning to read that?
No, I just ignored them. I opened it.
Law student. I'm going to root the law.
Shut up, Luke.
I object.
Objection.
Objection.
Overruled.
Luke is not a doctor.
Objection.
That's why they have those searchable engines you can get now. I understand they're very popular, the goggles or something.
The goggles. Oh, the goggles, they do nothing. A while back, while I was between games, I didn't really have much to do. I started working on my homebrew fantasy world again, which I hadn't done for a little while. I decided to put it up in my live journal to share with people, and I posted about how I like the stereotypical fantasy races, but I don't like when people just do, as John talked about, basically, let's change the dwarves a little bit, call them by a different name, but they're still dwarves. So I decided I like the general concept, but if I'm going to change something, I am going to change it. So I made an underground race called the Gren, who are dwarves if dwarves kind of made sense, because dwarves living underground doesn't make any sense. They can't really see in the dark very well. How do they grow their food? What happens? So
food's always been something that puzzled me.
Yeah, so
Luke has a brilliant answer.
I made a race that can just about take nourishment from anything. They can climb on virtually any surface, and they see really, really well in the dark. So they can live in underground and climb.
The practical
and
ramification is that to build these barrows out, they eat dirt.
See, and this is something I was kind
of... And it wigs out everyone else. It's very
this
cool.
This is kind of a worm, too. I mean...
Dirt eaters.
They can really eat anything at nourishment. Oh, Dan's talking. Yes. Be quiet, everybody.
Quiet, please. This is no me write podcast on the board and start circling letters. This is what I was talking about earlier with take physiology and work down from there. Because if you start with a race, obviously they have to live according to their physiology. It's inescapable. It doesn't matter.
Well, it is escapable. Look at all the fantasy settings out there now.
But that's the point. Look at what the race is. Look at how they survive. Look at the kind of environments you want them to live in. Start with that as the consistency of the race. And then from that, now you've got that freedom I was talking about earlier to start giving them culture. Said, okay, they all have to do this because their bodies require it. But now what can we do within that? Why? Where are the places they can start disagreeing with one another? And what are the kinds of things or schools of thought that would allow to pop up?
I also made them, you know how dwarves are always very gregarious. They love to drink. They love to party. Well, I made this race is very short-lived. They live like 30 years and they breed like rabbits. So the only thing they do to build monuments and big structures to make something that lasts, but they love to have fun because they have very short, intense lives, and they're dirty. Dirty, dirty.
What are some races that you guys thought were well-designed that didn't fit any of these nasties?
I got to say, as much as I dislike D&D these days, Warforged were very cool. I like the Warforged and Eberron a lot. Just the general concept was really, really cool.
My only problem with Warforged was from an economic standpoint.
Yeah, they didn't completely make sense, but they made enough I could hand wave the rest.
It was kind of interesting, though, because if you defeat like a first level Warforged, you just found like a EL4 treasure hoard.
Yeah, that's what killed my little Eberron campaign is when if we just keep killing these Warforged, we can melt them down for stuff. I'm like, yeah, but that's like desecrating a body. Like, we don't care. We're gonna go and melt down and get all the sediment.
So basically, you had a party of serial killers.
Weren't you in this? Weren't you playing?
So basically, you had a party of MMO players.
This is what predated our vampire game. We played an Eberron game that lasted like four.
Except for some reason, the MMO, I can kill a whole bear and it's only like a 1 in 4 chance that it will drop a fur.
Dan, what's your favorite race?
I don't know if this is a favorite race, but one that I think is well-designed in terms of fits what we're talking about is, and I'm going to go with Robotech here because I don't know how they portrayed most PD, because I know a lot was changed in the translation and edits, but the way that the Invid were portrayed in Robotech, I thought was very well done, particularly when they created like the difference between the Regis and the Regent and the Sentinel War, and I thought they did a great job there of creating a race, creating a physiology, and yet allowing them to disagree, allowing them to have culture, allowing the individuals to not necessarily get along with one another, that you definitely saw there was a difference between person and race. And I thought that was very well done. They didn't fit any obvious stereotypes because they kind of had the hive mind, but they didn't exactly have it. And they were a strongly biological race, but not entirely biological. And they did have some machines and such. So I thought that was a very well-designed and executed race.
Now, are you talking for setting or for playability?
Okay. I don't think they'd be playable, but okay. I'm talking for setting. Okay. I don't know they'd be playable outside of the fourth or fifth stage Invid, because the lower ones don't have a very fully developed mind, so I don't think they'd be playable.
See, I'll make a weird argument here. I don't think that races only have to be, like so much other stuff in a role-playing game, they only have to be as well-designed as the player's going to notice. You can have something that doesn't make any sense, but if the players are never going to really worry about it or find out why they don't make sense, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, I mean, the nasty converse of this. You could have everything perfect in the book and not play it, and it'll suck.
That's true. Playable races have to be very, very detailed because you have to have them make sense to the player who's going to want to know how things work, because all those little inconsistencies you don't fill in are going to come up time and time again.
Do you think that's why most playable races, are basically human with a twist? I mean, they're all roughly the same size and all walk upright on, have two arms and two legs. I mean, you think that's just a mechanical concession to how you're going to keep the people functioning together?
No, that was the first point I made with relatability. Everybody's very human-like because we're human, and going too far out of bounds of that is really hard to role play.
Well, no, but I mean, Luke has a valid point with relatability, but I was actually coming at it from a more mechanical angle of, is it just difficult to play a character that's of a race in a group that's very, very physically different?
Well, I think some of that's tradition, because where does a lot of this stuff come from? Well, it comes from movies and television. Well, in movies and television, you have to make the race humanoid because it's too expensive to have major scenes done all the time with a CG or well-puppeted race. But I think also, like Luke said, it's relatability. I had this exact problem that when I was trying to run Danvers for
some
people.
Only women can play Labians.
I was trying to run Danvers for some people. It just never gets old, does it?
No,
no, it really doesn't.
No, actually, the people a sanely proportioned woman could be a Labian. You would need an elephant with its tongue out all the time.
The people that played Danvers at Fear the Con for the second group, I actually got out the picture of the labium and showed them.
Haven't even seen the picture of the labium still.
I know. So you could just writhe in ignorance. They've actually seen it.
I can picture it. I've seen a labia before.
I'm picturing a labia writhing. Is that
When I was trying to play Danvers, I would put down some of these races as labians not being one of them. And some of the players were complaining that they didn't know if they could play the races because they were too inhuman. That as they looked at the psychologies, they looked at the physical appearances, they're like, I don't know how to play this race because I have not lived life with these kinds of legs and arms and or possibly non-legs and arms and spending my life suspended from a ceiling or whatever the case is. I'm just making crap up. But
well, how do you find your motivation as a spider person? Are you all about the egg sacs? Mm-hmm. Or
you
want to
kill high elves for Loth?
I want to spend the last bit of this episode trying to give some really specific advice about actually going about races in your setting. We talked earlier about moving from physiology to culture to the individual, but let's talk about some other things in there, like, for example, balancing these races within a setting.
Now, it's always easy when whatever system you're using gives you the race creation rules so you can balance stuff out, but unfortunately, not many places do that, especially if they don't, you know, it's not a generic system. They don't really want you to create stuff. Or
right.
Or D&D, where there's not any strict guidelines. It's kind of more, here's the general ideas of what we do, but it's not perfect.
It's all swag.
Well, you know what a lot of systems do is they kind of start with humans as the zero point, and then what they do is they give you perks and quirks that are supposed to kind of balance you back to zero. So, for example, if your race is stronger than humans, then it also has to have some other negative that brings it back to zero. For example, you can't be as dexterous.
The strong one's always dumb.
Yeah, well, no, with the cliche, for example, you've got humans, for example, which would have a neutral strength and dexterity, and then you've got elves, which would be more dexterous but weaker, and then you've got dwarves, which are less dexterous but stronger.
So you're describing
or
the
there's
D&D
also
PhD
perks
right
and quirks,
here.
For example, you know, night vision or slow metabolism or things like that. But I think there's two types. I mean, I think there's the kind that is mechanically useful in the game that could translate to advantages either in combat or when undertaking a task. And then there's also perks and quirks, which I think are just more for role-playing flavor that wouldn't necessarily translate mechanically into anything. I mean, so for example, if your character had a high dexterity because of his race, that would be great for picking locks. Where if your character, because of his race, couldn't eat chocolate, I don't think that would necessarily translate much into a benefit that was mechanical to the game, but could still have some role-playing ramifications. Yeah,
but then you're playing the dog guy.
You're playing dog boy in Rifts.
Let me pick over several things you said in there. Let's start with humans as the zero point. I think that's a very, very useful design point. When I was messing around with some systems in the past, I tried creating a system where humans were not the zero point, that humans did not have average in every attribute, that you know, I basically took it and compared it to what I saw as the average of my races, where so humans may be actually below average in strength if everything else in the setting is really strong. And what I found quickly was that this made it harder for people to relate to the setting, because when they pick it up, obviously the understanding they're starting with, not being in my head, is humans. They understand what a human is. So they're probably going to compare everything to the stats on a human. And I found that actually made the setting a little more confusing in terms of how it played out in the rules to have humans have non-average stats.
Well, and you know, as we're talking about with races kind of being stereotypes, especially in the last 10 years or so, most games where you have a lot of races will have, like you said, the humans kind of as a zero point, but their big gimmick is usually adaptability. Humans are very adaptable, so they have a choice of this that other people don't get. And other races aren't adaptable. So, you know, you get your warlike dwarves, you get your aloof elves, you get the stuff we just talked about.
That's something, not to get into philosophy tangent, or something I've always found fascinating, that seems so consistent in every fantasy and sci-fi setting I've seen, that with humans, we always, in terms of the stats, tend to come in a little bit low. We're not the strongest race, we're not the fastest race, we're not the smartest race, we don't have the most technology.
Oh, we don't have any weaknesses.
But somehow we're always resourceful. We have this intangible, almost divine property by which we always win through.
Well,
that
we
you
can
almost
always
can't
make
quantify.
It to 20th level in
that's,
second
that's
edition.
Right.
That's because role-playing humans are Americans.
Wow.
That's Matt at feartheboot.com.
No, run with this. This is good.
I want Matt to explain this role-playing humans are Americans thing.
Well, at least with most role-playing systems that I'm familiar with, they tend to be written from a Western European based viewpoint, where we're going out into space and we're going manifest destiny, or we're, you know,
F yeah.
Or in the fantasy tropes where we're the civilized people trying to expand into the unknown frontiers, or, you know, protecting ourselves from the hordes of the less civilized races.
You know, actually, now that you put it that way, I'm running through various settings in my head, and it's not 100% right.
No,
but it's 99% right.
See, I'm running through various nations on Earth and statting them out in my head right now. Well, but I'm not going to put that on the
other thing is the
I'm not going to discuss that on the forums with our international listeners.
Well, I see what he's saying. It's actually probably the better word for more accurately describe what he was saying is their Western cultures more than their Americans.
That's my cultural bias.
Right.
Shining through.
But the way he's describing it, I think actually, yeah, he's right, because all the settings I can think of, the humans are always either very Western, or if they're not very Western,
they're the monk class.
Well, or they tend to represent Western guilt. That yeah. They are so barbaric and so violent.
And they ran off
so
the Shadowrun
vile.
Indians with their magic.
Yeah, exactly. But they represent either Western ideal or Western guilt. It's one of the two. But
or a cosmopolitan view of how we would like to see society.
Yeah, humans are the only plural society. I mean, we just talked about this for 30 minutes.
Well, go ahead.
On that point, there are a lot of German RPGs and French RPGs that I've never read, and you got to wonder, how do they write up their, you know, basic human? Is it from their cultural standpoint? I mean, why would they
be very interesting?
Yeah, I think
so
too. I mean, I've seen the translations of some of these, but
man, we need to do a whole show on international RPGs.
If we could get our hands on some and read them.
Okay, one quick thing. I did actually read an Australian sci-fi novel. It was called The Outback Stars, where it was Australians beat everyone else in the space because they made a great discovery. So it was the whole future development of space and spacefaring culture was Australian-based.
That would be awesome. I love Australia. Their culture is so much fun.
There was a comic that would be so great if the British beat the Americans into space, seizing Nazi technology.
The change in flavor was really, really interesting.
That would just be a blast. Huh. I gotta say, I hope they do beat us into like colonizing, so I can go to like Australian Mars and be like, yes, awesome.
Okay. Well, getting back to this, the next thing that Tex brought up in his points earlier was the second one is numeric balancing. Once you start from that point, so you have the 0 point of humans or whatever race is right for your particular setting, and from there to do numeric balancing out. And I think that's a great thing to do. If you take your races, you want to make sure they're fair and balanced and playable together, then sit down and make sure that for every plus one a race gets, they have a minus one somewhere to balance that out. And sometimes it gets a little hard to balance because let's say this race is maybe a little bit weaker, but they get claws or they can spit acid or whatever. How do you balance that?
You know what race always gets claws? Cat people.
Well, I've seen it done a couple different ways in different games. If you're playing Heroes, it costs you 25 points to be an elf or some mm-hmm. point total that I don't actually recall, but it's some significant
Keith
portion
Gerson, Jim and Buffalo
of your
duty.
Some significant portion of your beginning points goes to being an elf. If you're playing Shadowrun, a game which some people don't like at this table, but you know,
no. Just one person,
just one,
you know, you have to put your character creation matrix. You have to prioritize being a race that's not human.
And then you have to shoot an orc with a machine gun.
But that's just because it's fun.
The other thing that I found that's not a good idea is to use, I'm going to call these soft balancers. For example, and Tex talked about this with the chocolate thing, that I have a race who has a plus two to strength, no minuses to any stats, but they can't eat chocolate. Let's use one that's a little bit more sensible. I'm going to play a race. I'm going to play Tolkien Dwarves. And I get a slight plus to strength, a slight plus to con. But in return, I'm afraid of horses. I think that is a crap balancer. Because the players will always find some way to completely negate
there
that.
There are soft balancers they can't get.
Not
Orcish Sunlight Aversion. Yeah. Sorry, you're going
well,
outside.
In my mind, that's not a soft balancer. Because that's not role-playing. It's if you walk into sunlight, you take this much damage
over
this
much
time.
Oh, no, you meant just role-play thing?
I'm talking about things that have no numeric representation.
Well, not only that. You're a second-class citizen.
Not only that.
Yeah, that's another one.
You don't ever want to give a race a disadvantage that is going to hinder play. Like, you don't like water or horses. How does he travel when the rest of every what everybody else.
So either he finds a war dog, in which case this becomes no penalty at all.
Exactly.
Or
the entire party avoids horses. So what's the difference?
Right. So what's the difference? The guy who can't go into town. Well, I'll let you play Noel, but all the townspeople hate you. Okay, outside of the one brief obligatory lynch mob that doesn't actually catch you, because if they did, it would ruin the game. You don't ever use it.
Yeah,
get ahead of disguise, move on.
It's a non-drawback. So I really, really hate to use drawbacks for races that are pure now, role-playing or setting-based.
There are ways around that, though, and some systems do where you actually get either some in-game reward, whether it be a fate chip or XP when your whatever hindrance your race took or whatever you took in character creation comes up in play. You get a bonus for it, for it coming up.
Well,
so,
but do humans
that's the
get
carrot
a,
to get the player to right. actually bring it up?
But exactly.
That shouldn't be there, because what do humans get for being average?
Well, I'm saying that if they
every
take,
time I'm average, do I get a fate chip?
This is one of the minus things to offset a plus thing.
Oh, okay, I see what you're saying. If that's how you balance it purely. Then,
well, no, there are systems that do it
well.
I think
what Luke's saying is it gives the GM and the player some reason to actually do it, because we said, okay, if you've got a dwarf and you're afraid of horses, basically the whole party just avoids horses and there's no difference. But if you actually have something come up where being afraid of horses actually penalized you or actually hindered you,
well,
then you get a little reward. So I think it encourages you to at least play the
hindrance. Like Spirit of the Century, I'm afraid of horses. Oh, look, I'm going to go and get on a horse, screw my hindrance, and the game master says, here's a fate chip. You're afraid of horses. You can't do this. And you've got to either accept it and say, okay, I'm afraid of horses. I'm not going to do this.
Wait, that's stupid. You have to pay them off to play their...
Or you can say, okay, well, here, GM, take one of my fate chips. I'm getting over my fear for this scene. You know, it all depends.
But no, I think he has a point, too, that, I mean, you risk paying the characters to play their quirks.
Yeah.
And you get the even scarier thing of then the player who's constantly pandering to his quirks just to get all the
there's always a limit to it. I mean, it's not like you just do it every time, but if it's a scene that's important to the character where this is a big thing, that's when if they do it themselves, you reward them. If they don't do it, you give them a little carrot saying, hey, this is something in your character.
Well, this is one of those great many things that I would say, I'm not saying it can't work. I'm just saying it's very dangerous, and I've seen it abused far more times than I've seen it work. And I can't, like, for example, back in D&D 2nd Edition, somebody would play an elf. Well, they get a plus to this and a plus to that, and they speak extra languages and bonus this and bonus that, but your downside is you can't make to level 20. So what happens? The game never gets played to level 20.
Right.
Or if you get to level 20, you just allow the elf to go and progress anyway, because the game's not going to be fun if he's stuck at level 12
well,
and everybody
you know,
else is level 20.
Elf can make it to an unlimited number of levels in the bard class.
So,
11th level bard kicked out my window.
Or, you know, and that's suddenly, well, that's your drawback. Or you can only reach level 20 in a certain class.
The rationale in 2E for why humans ruled the world was that all these level limits were on the other races. Mm-hmm. And they said in the DM's guide that if you take out the level limits, you have to make a world where humans are just slaves because everyone else is better than them. See, I read that thinking, okay, did you?
That's what happens when you take
this?
Gary Gygax off of the typewriter. In second edition.
Well, to be fair, immortality is a really tough perk to get around.
I gotta say, you have to balance the individuals, not the entire race. And here's what I mean by that: if you, and this is another one I've seen in role playing games such as D&D, you set a game where, well, this race has all these pluses and bonuses, but the drawback is no one in their race can play a fighter or cleric. They can only be mages and thieves. Well, what the hell does that matter when the guy next to me is playing a whatever mage?
Yeah.
Suddenly he's more powerful than me, and the drawback is that some imaginary his race elsewhere can't be a fighter. That really balances things out in the here and now. You have to balance every individual of the race. You can't just look at the gestalt of the race and say, oh, gee, well, they're culturally weaker because of this, because that has no bearing whatsoever on actual
game. I have another problem.
Well, that's what I was bringing up earlier. Is the lack of choice really a quirk?
No, I would not at
no,
all.
No, it's not.
No. And my
because if it sucks to play an elven fighter, you just won't play an elven fighter is all it comes down to.
Another one of my big problems with races is when you have the fluff that is completely watered down when it comes to mechanics. Like elves, D&D elves live for 400 years. Dwarves live for like 200 plus. That should be a big deal, and it doesn't mean anything at all. You get your regular bonuses. Oh yeah, you live for 400 years, and that's one of the things that's always been really hard to relate to. It's like, okay, I'm 120 years old, but I'm still like a teenager. I don't, you know, why?
I can't advance past level 12 because I have too much time on my hands.
Exactly.
And I'm on the same development scale relative to my position in age as a human is.
Exactly.
So I'm a teenager when I'm 60.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense, and it's hard to get around, and it gets watered down. Like, again, back to my homebrew, I haven't got to the point where I'm posting about elves, but when I did elves, I'm like, okay, I'm going to make a race that's immortal and better than you, which is elves that are always, my elves are better than you. There's a huge drawback to it, but they do really, really shine. But to play them, you've got to take on a really, really huge burden.
I'm actually going to throw out a counter argument here.
Counter me. Do
just,
it.
Just one tiny little part, at least on the aging thing.
Uh-huh.
You know, when humans only lived for 30 years, they got mature a lot faster socially. Now that we're living for longer and longer, our adolescent period
can
last into well into the 20s. I know some people who...
See, I thought that was just because of the internet.
No,
I blame the internet.
As a 22-year-old, it's because we have no responsibility. We can just go to college forever and let our parents pay for everything.
Yeah, college was pretty awesome.
Woo-hoo!
I'm not gonna lie, college uptime to school were pretty awesome.
Yeah, I'm so not gonna touch that, or I'm gonna be here for another hour.
All right, I think that's gonna wrap it up for this show. So thank you guys for tuning in, and we will catch you next time.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2008, fully owned by its hosts. Our theme song was written and performed by Tim White. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com.